This is New England Public Radio's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. Today's podcast focuses on guitarist Joe Pass, who had a genius for making the impossible look easy. Joe Pass enjoyed 20 years of renown as one of the greatest jazz guitar players in the world before he died in 1994 at age 65. He was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey in 1929 and was an underground legend until he was in his mid-40s. His early inspiration was Gene Autry, the singing cowboy of movie fame, and Autry's guitarist Roy Smeck, who was known as the Wizard of the Strings. Joe was encouraged by his father, a mill worker in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, who recognized his son's precocious musical talent as an avenue out of the Rust Belt. Pass began playing professionally at the age of 14 and eventually toured with the bands of Tony Pastor, Charlie Barnett, and Ray McKinley. Joe settled in New York in the late 40s and spent nights at the Royal Roost listening to Charlie Parker and playing jam sessions around town. But heroin addiction, the scourge of modern jazz in the post-war years, claimed him, and he spent over a decade chasing a fix and looking for gigs. Joe lived for a time in New Orleans, where he played for strippers and resided in a building that housed saxophonist Brew Moore and the novelist William Burroughs, who just published his landmark 1953 debut, Junkie. From there, Pass moved west to work in show bands in Las Vegas, but he got busted for possession of marijuana in 1954 and sentenced to the Federal Narcotics Prison in Fort Worth, Texas. Upon release 4 years later, he returned to work in Vegas and in Southern California, but still hampered by dope, he entered Synanon in 1960. A year later, Pacific Jazz released the album Sounds of Synanon, which featured Pass and fellow residents of the pioneering rehab facility in Santa Monica. Leonard Feather reviewed the album for Downbeat in 1962 and said, "This album does more than merely present a group of good musicians. It unveils a star. In Joe Pass, Synanon and Pacific Jazz have discovered a major jazz talent." Pass remained at Synanon until 1963. Then for the next decade, he worked as a studio musician around Los Angeles. He earned the praise of guitarist Wes Montgomery, and he recorded with Gerald Wilson's orchestra. He's featured on two of Wilson's masterful Pacific Jazz albums, Moment of Truth and Portraits. From the latter, recorded in 1963, Pass plays acoustic guitar on Wilson's arrangement of Round Midnight. Harold Land is the tenor saxophone soloist. That's Joe Pass with Gerald Wilson's orchestra. On June 2, 1972, Joe attended a now-famous concert at the Santa Monica Civic Center starring Ella Fitzgerald and Count Basie. It was presented by Norman Granz, the famed impresario, and also featured Roy Eldridge and Joe's friend Stan Getz. Granz was only vaguely familiar with Joe Pass at the time, but the buzz backstage about the guitarist prompted Granz and Oscar Peterson to check him out the following night at Dante's in Hollywood. Joe was appearing there with Oscar's former sideman, Herb Ellis. Granz's biographer, Tad Hershon, says Granz and Peterson were equally awed by Pass's command of his instrument and the precision with which, as a solo guitarist, he used single notes to convey chords, bass, and melody, in ways that emulated saxophone solo lines and piano accompaniment. In a later interview with her, Sean, Peterson said he was impressed by what he called Pass's invention. The way he sat up and improvised, it just rolled out of him. Lyrically, Joe had such a sense of invention with the ballads. Norman knew without saying anything what Joe stood for and who Joe was. 13 years earlier, in 1959, Norman Granz had left Los Angeles and moved to Switzerland, and the following year he'd sold Verve Records, the jazz label with which his name remained synonymous. He spent the next decade amassing a sizable collection of modern art that included works by his friend Pablo Picasso. That same decade saw a tumult in the music world brought on by the soaring popularity of rock. On a smaller scale, straight-ahead jazz was being marginalized as free jazz and fusion dominated the jazz press and record business. In 1971, Granz told Leonard Feather, "It's a disgrace what the jazz artists of today are being forced to do, recording material that is all wrong for them. It's criminal, too, that someone like Sarah Vaughan was allowed to go without making a single record for 5 years. Record executives today are only concerned with the fact that they can gross $9 million with the Rolling Stones. They forget that a profit is still a profit, and you're still making money if you only net $9,000. I keep telling people that, and they think I'm crazy." As it happened, the Santa Monica concert was a prelude to Granz getting back in the business. In 1973, he established Pablo Records, the same year that another Californian, Carl Jefferson, established Concord Jazz. The immediate success of both labels signaled that a substantial audience was still eager to hear music played by established and emerging players of mainstream jazz. Like Verve, Pablo Records reflected Granz's personal tastes in his ongoing devotion to Ella Fitzgerald, Oscar Peterson, Count Basie, Sarah Vaughan, and Roy Eldridge, as well as Milt Jackson, Sweets Edison, and Zoot Sims. But it was Joe Pass who was the least renowned of these artists when he signed with Granz, and the association brought him a first and lasting brush with popular and critical acclaim. Like his touring concert package, Jazz at the Philharmonic, Granz utilized the stable of artists under contract to him as interchangeable parts, and Pass fit in with virtually everyone at Pablo, appearing as a sideman with the label Stars and leading solo and small combo recordings of his own. Joe's first date at Pablo came as a complete surprise when he was brought in to play on a session with Duke Ellington. Duke's Big Four, recorded in January 1973, was one of the bandleader's final dates and his only album featuring a guitarist in a solo role. It kicks off with Joe Pass on Cottontail. Pass then joined the dynamic duo of Peterson and bassist Niels Henning Ørsted Pedersen and went on to tour and record extensively with them for nearly two decades. Their sensational debut, The Trio, was recorded live at the London House in Chicago in 1973. Ellington's spiritual theme, Come Sunday, was Joe's solo feature at the London House, and it remained a staple of his repertoire with Peterson and Pedersen. Thank you. A memorial tribute to Ellington was the focus of Joe's first album as a leader for Pablo. Portraits of Duke Ellington was recorded less than a month after Duke's death in May 1974. I've long found it hard to select just one tune from the record for airplay in Jazz on the Mode, but for now let's go with the album's opener, Satin Doll. Equal credit for this gem goes to bassist Ray Brown and drummer Bobby Durham. That's Joe Pass playing Duke Ellington's Satin Doll. A month after Joe's debut with the Peterson Trio, he and Ella Fitzgerald appeared together at Carnegie Hall for that year's Newport in New York Jazz Festival. The performance was so well received and agreeable to the principals that they recorded a duo album, Take Love Easy, the following month. Pass told Ella's biographer Stuart Nicholson, "The first album I did with her, we went into a studio and Norman Granz brought a bunch of tunes in, lead sheets and songs. I had no idea whether she'd want to rehearse or what keys she sang in. But she just picked a tune like Gee Baby, Ain't I Good to You, and I said, what key? She said, well, and just sort of hummed a little bit. I found the key, and we just did a whole album like that. I could change keys with her, anything I wanted to do. She's just there. She hears it, no problem. It's like another musician, sort of like a horn player." Downbeat's review of Take Love Easy praised Pass for solos that are intricate but not flashy. A thoroughly disciplined musician, he never tries to upstage her. Ella and Joe's complete concert at Hanover, Germany in 1975 circulates on YouTube. From it, here's the First Lady of Song lauding Joe and introducing what she calls a torchy song, the Julie London classic, Cry Me a River.
Now you say you're lonely, you cry the whole night through. Well, you can cry me a river, cry.
When playing solo concerts was first proposed to Pass in 1974, he was dubious, but Granz proved to be persuasive. Tad Hirshhorn's biography reports that when Joe expressed skepticism, Granz said, "Piano players do it, Segovia does it." Pass countered that Segovia is a classical player, but Granz persisted. What followed was Virtuoso, Joe's second album for Pablo. It was the first of many solo sessions he made for the label, and one that elicited from Downbeat an observation about Pass that applies to virtually everything he ever played. If one definition of genius is that it can make the impossible look easy, Pass certainly qualifies on this count alone. For additional material on Joe Pass, including the documentary An Evening with Joe Pass, visit the jazz blog at nepr.net. Thanks to Katie Wright for production assistance. For Jazz Beats, I'm Tom Reaney. Thank you.
Thank you.